of home were burning brightly when I left so long ago.
You're listening to Can't Do Nothing With Love, an award-winning short story collection written and read by Ellen Morris Pruitt. Today's episode features Superman at the Manor. Mother should be grateful for an attentive son, but she's glowering at me, her pug nose crinkled, as if I've spilled sticky pickle juice on her kitchen counter. Mother no longer owns a kitchen counter, and I no longer am a child with clumsy mitts attempting to fix a pickle and cheese sandwich. Mother now lives in this lovely retirement home, where the management conducts happy hour every Monday and Thursday at 4:30, cover charge $1, all the drinks you can down for free. "Where's Vincent?" people ask when I fail to show up. Mother, who has inexplicably changed her name to Olivia since arriving at the manor, does not tell me of the concern over my absence. Doris does. Doris always sits at our round table. Doris went to kindergarten with Mother back when children learned under the thwat of a ruler. Doris's mind has flown the coop, an undisciplined yard bird of a brain, squawking and laying eggs of logical incoherence. Doris and I get along well, which makes Mother jealous, I suppose. "How many does that make?" Mother gives my highball the stink eye. Her obsessive compulsiveness, newly diagnosed by her occupational therapist, manifests itself in counting my drinks. "You tell me." I raise my glass so she can see the amber bourbon swirling and melting the clinking ice. "My father drank nothing but Jack Daniels, loyal to his home state of Tennessee, and I'm a man of tradition, even if Mother and I have migrated over the mountains to Charlotte, North Carolina. Lots of new money, all of it at the manor." "Don't hound the boy, Olivia." Doris bats her eyes at me. Unlike most of the milky orbs proliferating at the manor, Doris's eyes shine bright, brittle as the enameled back of a cockroach. 40 years ago, Doris and I would have been soulmates. "Drinking gave you that gut. A paunchy gut's no good for your heart." Mother, whose pearls of wisdom include, "Don't pee at the McDonald's unless you at least buy a coffee," picks through the assorted nuts management offers, with no irony whatsoever, as hors d'oeuvres. Usually they offer crackers along with the nuts. Yes, crackers and nuts at an old folks' home, but I never eat them, too damp and limp, as if the crackers have been touched by many disdainful fingers before returned to the communal box. "I'm surprised these nuts aren't accompanied by demence." I gesture with a cashew at Mr. and Mrs. Thompson, who never say a word, just sit there like puppets whose masters left the stage for a cigarette break, their jaws slack, their trembling fingers splayed on the table. Doris, however, after a bit of explanation, declares my comment clever. "I like your glasses," she says, leaning her elbow on the arm of my chair so she can invade my personal space. "They have no glass in them." Mother has been staring at my face since I arrived, but in her typical passive-aggressive fashion says nothing until Doris broaches the subject. "They're fake," she adds disparagingly. "Of course they're fake." I adjust the heavy rims. "Real glasses would not a costume make." "What costume?" Mother asks, but she's really not interested. She's intent on watching old Mr. Stevens roil his way around the tables. The man's bad hip throws him from side to side like a ship at stormy sea. Sometimes he joins us, sometimes he doesn't. I have no idea what goes on between him and Mother. "What do you mean, what costume?" I am not going to explain the obvious to Mother. Her speech therapist, a woman named Alice, who wears one of those adult retainers so that she speaks with a lisp, tells me the elderly must be given the opportunity to grasp reality on their own, or their dignity is infringed. I don't know why a speech therapist is the woman buffering reality for Mother. The lineup of therapists at the manor would make your head spin if you let it. "A costume because Sunday is Halloween," Doris correctly observes, as Mr. Stevens tacks and heads in our direction. Doris glances his way, then dunks a cashew in her gin and tonic. "I just love Halloween." She shivers her shoulders, then sucks on her cashew, raising her eyebrows at me. Sometimes Doris feigns enthusiasm in order to appear more lively, and thus further removed from the hour of her demise. One could see it as pitiful, but I appreciate the effort. "Hey!" Mr. Stevens is staring boggle-eyed at our table. "Somebody punked the crackers!" He assesses the innocent Thompsons who never drink or eat the crackers. They only come to be included at dinner. "Was it you, Georgie?" he interrogates Mr. Thompson, his voice erupting with the suddenness of irritable bowel syndrome, never anticipated, hardly ever desired, at least not by me. He makes Mother querulous. "You needn't join us," I point out. "Other tables might not be cracker-free. I am hoping for a gentle, convivial evening, an outcome made more remote by Mr. Stevens' presence." Sure enough, as soon as he maneuvers into a chair, Mother rounds on me. "Did you reserve us a table?" Then she's on to explaining to everyone, again, how seating in the bistro is on a first-come, first-served basis unless you have a reservation, and her son, Vincent, never remembers to make reservations. The Thompsons slowly shift their gaze to me. "There are plenty of tables to go around," I soothe everyone. "Have we ever been left standing at the door unseated? I've been joining Mother here for happy hour followed by dinner for 6 months, and we've never once had trouble finding a seat. Miss Mildred won't be left out in the cold, will she, folks?" "Olivia," she corrects me. "Olivia." Doris rolls her eyes. "That old canard," Mr. Stevens says. "His wife is in the Alzheimer's unit, but he's the one you can't follow half the time. We were talking about Vincent's lovely costume," Doris strokes my sleeve. "That outdated suit looks like a jazz cat from Skid Row," Mr. Stevens says, hooking a forefinger into the bowl of nuts and sliding the bowl his way. "We used to wear better suits on Friday nights at the lodge, and we weren't exactly fashion dandies. Who ate all the cashews?" He shoves the bowl of nuts aside. "You missed demence," I josh. Mr. Stevens gives me a blank look, the skin on his jowls sagging into tomorrow. "Is that your father's white shirt?" Mother narrows her eyes at me. I smooth the front of my costume. "Maybe." I straighten my shoulders, proclaiming in a loud voice, "To serve and protect." "You a Marine?" Mr. Stevens pauses, his vodka tonic halfway to his lips. "Honorable discharge?" "No. To serve and protect. That's the Charlotte Police Department," Doris, quick as a fox, makes a checking motion in the air with her finger. "Cha-ching." I frown. Doris might be right. "You've joined the police?" Mother looks very worried. Her mouse fluff hair is smushed on one side from her afternoon nap. I wish she had brushed it before coming to happy hour. I don't like picturing my mother's vulnerable head on the pillow, hands clasped beneath her chin. Stiff-arming it, I reach for the ceiling. "It's a plane!" "You're Superman?" Even Doris seems doubtful. "Do I look like Superman?" "Marines are good fellows, don't get me wrong," Mr. Stevens says, setting his glass on the table with exacting deliberation. "It's just that they believe themselves to be the only good fellows. Just like the Flyboys, everyone in the war had their own view of the service, and in my opinion, that usually meant their branch of service was better than anybody else's." "If you're Superman, where's your S?" Mother, whose brain locks in like a rat terrier on a chew toy, won't let go. "Hello, hello, hello!" Miss Langley, the management's representative, waves both hands as if we were castaways who've drifted far at sea. She always says everything thrice. Wants to wake the old people up, wants to get their brains in gear, and wants to actually communicate. While I'm formulating a witty remark about the function of the hand wave, Miss Langley says something I don't catch. Mother is glaring at me. I check the table. 3 $1 bills. I am the fourth. "Oh, drat, I do believe I've forgotten the entrance fee," Mr. Stevens snorts. "And they talk about old people. This one would forget his marbles if they weren't glued on." Ignoring the jab, I pry open my wallet. "A man certainly can't come to see his mother without paying." "You've had 4 bourbons, Mother addresses this to Doris, probably to cut off a defense from that corner of the table. 3, I correct. 4. As I slap the bill on the table, Miss Langley chirps, "Can I get y'all some more nuts?" Miss Langley considers herself young because she works around so many old people, but I see a faint mustache on her upper lip. That doesn't happen to young people, unless they are male. "We want the mints," Mr. Stevens interrupts. "Well, mints are a nice idea," Miss Langley indulges the old guy. "He said we had mints." Mr. Stevens points a crooked finger at me. I delicately shrug, as if unwilling to indict an old guy's confusion. Miss Langley would probably not consider my wordplay clever. I've noticed the management tends to frown on dementia jokes. "Just smell that roast beef," Miss Langley sniffs deeply, fluttering her eyelids. "It's going to be a good time at the old feed bag tonight." That is the exact type of crude phraseology which led me to advise Mother against moving into the manor in the first place. When we toured the facility last spring, Miss Langley said, "A real kerfuffle," when talking about the weekly bunco game and on the potty, in referring to companion help, but mother insisted she needed someone to look after her as if she were childless, as if I did not exist. "Vincent, you've bought some new glasses." Miss Langley tosses me a big smile, like I'm one of her particularly bright charges. "He's dressed up as a jazz player for Halloween." Mr. Stevens scoots back from the table. "Time to get in the mess hall." See, it's catching. I slowly sip the last of my drink. It's impolite to exit the table while your companions are still eating or drinking, but it's also impolite to note impoliteness. You can only hope your actions speak louder than your words. "Well, we've run into a real kerfuffle," as Miss Langley would say. By the time we arrive in the bistro, the only tables remaining are two tops, so three tables must be scouted up to make seating for six. The old people do not like rearranging furniture. I suppose the unfamiliar placement encourages tripping. They all stand by, arms hanging, as I tug one table after another across the recalcitrant carpet, Miss Langley supervising. When I sit, I'm winded from the exertion as well as the unnecessary directions given by Miss Langley. I don't have time to catch my breath before the girl with the twirly hair is handing out menus. I take one from her offering hand, fan it across my flushed face. The uncertainty produced by the migrating furniture snowballs, and suddenly the old people's menu selection is impaired. Mr. Thompson is writing salad bar onto his menu when there is no salad bar in the bistro. Mrs. Thompson, missing the point entirely, argues with him over his dressing choice, while I must explain to Doris that green beans come with the roast beef, but new potatoes are an alternative to the rice. "Rice or potatoes?" She fixes me with her gaze. "Is that it?" Her question implies something else is possible. I scan the sheet of paper to see what I might have missed. "Cornbread or rolls?" Mother stabs her pencil in Doris's direction. "Tea or water with lemon?" "Who wants to make their water taste like an acid wedge lemon?" Mr. Stevens marks his menu with a flourish. "It's not like we're gouty around here." I return to the menu. Why did I think they were offering pickle and cheese sandwiches tonight? And mark the dinner rolls. After we hand our selections to the twirly-haired young lady whose name I cannot recall, I look around the room for a man named Jemison. Kurt, I believe, wears a black toupee. Last week Jemison mentioned that his nephew might have an opening at his pipe and fitting store. Salesman was my impression. Mother misinterprets my gander around the room. "You can't get a drink in here." She knifes a wedge of butter onto a saltine cracker and nips it with her teeth. "You got to go to the bar in the lounge. Run you full freight in there." I draw myself up, wiping the sweat belatedly beating my upper lip. It would be nice if the young lady would return so I could request a glass of ice water, but my dinner companions needn't know all my secrets. "I'm looking for a man with a toupee," I carefully explain. Mr. Stevens barks out a laugh that descends into roomy hacking. Cupping his shaking hand around his mouth, he struggles until his face shades to brick red. Then the fit subsides, and he croaks, "Man with a toupee! You gotta narrow that down, son." The appellation leaves me wondering if things have progressed further than I thought between Mr. Stevens and Mother, notwithstanding the crazy wife and the Alzheimer's unit. Once when I was kvetching to Doris about the unseemly relationship, she shrugged and said, "That sort of thing happens." The thought makes me slightly queasy in the abdomen. "You want to add a toupee to that get-up? Stuff it under your ratty hat?" Mother insults the black fedora I was lucky enough to find at the vintage store on South Central Street. Of course, the chapeau began life as a top hat, but I creased the crown with a book overnight. Worked out fine, if you ask me, necessity being the mother of invention and all. I adjust the hat's rakish tilt. "I have been offered a job by one of your co-residents."
"A job?"
Mr. Stevens looks puzzled, concerned even. "You want to start a new job at your age, son? Stevens men only have so much oomph in them. Your grandfather killed over at 63. Mother lays her hand on Mr. Stevens' arm. "That's my Vincent, Mac." "Oh, I bet he's got a lot of good days left," Doris smirks, a drop of iced tea on the tip of her nose. Suddenly, I am worn out with the banter. It takes so much to keep a dinner conversation on track, particularly when your table companions are rampaging from topic to topic like marauding bull elephants. I am grateful when the unnamed young lady arrives with the food. "Vincent," she says as she sets my plate in front of me. "Olivia, Doris, Mac." She ends with the Thompsons, each of us getting a name reminder, as if a spate of pre-dinner low blood sugar has erased our known identities. to return only when the coconut cream pie is served. The group downs their roast beef with gusto, sawing with steak knives, snapping with dentures, but I eat in silence, conserving my energy. I don't feel well. As if unbeknownst to me, one's heart is structured with a plug that stoppers energy, and mine has been pulled. I hear Doris's voice, her creaky vowels, and Mr. Stevens's creaky consonants, mixed with Mother's wobbly, questioning sentences. Underneath it all, the Thompsons' low murmuring runs the bass line, the old people creating a rift of the human throat, rising, falling, pausing to breathe, their hesitancy interrupting the phrasing. The harmony produces a sound so lovely to the ear, a jungle gem in the sun, scuffed dirt, the song of birds, not birds, my turn on the swing, if I can just touch it, but the more I strain, the farther away the notes twirl, and I'm left staring at my own shaking hand. Out of the melody, a chorus repeats, "Vincent! Vincent!" But I can't rise to the occasion. Mother's face waffles into sight, and the love I have for her tightens around my heart like the twist tie on the bread loaf, twisting tighter and tighter, sealing in the yeasty bread until I can't breathe. My fingers claw at Daddy's shirt. The buttons pop and the fabric rips. If I could just... "Superman!" someone cries. "Mama!" I croak and fade away. I awake, propped against the wall, my palms flat on the floor. A woman I should recognize squats in front of me. "A moment of weakness," she lisps through the retainer. "You'll be fine as soon as you catch your breath." "Alice," I say, and she smiles. "Your costume was too tight." I'll run my hands down my chest. It's bare. Alice twists to look over her shoulder. "Matt cut you free." Mr. Stevens pops from behind Alice, steak knife raised.
"Nicked right through it."
Doris appears on Alice's other side. "Zip, zip," she beams. Mr. and Mrs. Thompson smack their dentures, say not a word. "Where's Mama?" I rub my forehead, confused by an image of a loaf of bread. My displaced fedora rolls empty by my side. A hand reaches, pats me on the knee. "Here I am, son." Mother is seated to my right, her legs sticking straight out. She and I must look like a couple of rag dolls, slung away in childish boredom. The toes of her black shoes point toward the ceiling. "Rag dolls," I say. She offers me my fedora. "Clark Kent." Doris hands each of us a slice of coconut cream pie. We finish our meal on the floor, while Mr. Stevens recounts loud enough for the entire bistro to hear the story of how he saved the life of his son. Thanks for listening. To contribute to Church Health Center, a charity providing health care for the working uninsured, please follow the link at can'tdonothingwithlove.wordpress.com or visit churchhealthcenter.org. Message me on Facebook at Can't Do Nothing With Love. Our music, "The Lights of Home," was written and sung by Mr. Rob Pate. Rock on, Rob.
Oh, he's the light of home. Thank you. Thank you very much.